Welcome back to the Roundtable. I'm Alan Chartok. One of the journalists most closely associated with Boston is heading west tonight to the Berkshires to deliver the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute's annual Mona Sherman Memorial Lecture at the Colonial Theater in Pittsfield. The topic of Mike Barnicle's address, which begins at 6 and is free and open to the public, is optimism, America's most ignored asset. A Massachusetts native who began his career as a prominent political speechwriter, Barnicle has written for the Boston Globe, Boston Herald, New York Daily News, and the Daily Beast, to name a few. He's a frequent presence on television as a member of the Morning Joe panel on MSNBC and has produced award-winning documentaries. Mike Barnicle, welcome to the Roundtable.
Well, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, Mike, I'd love to know about what optimism we really have in America that's being ignored.
Well, first of all, I'm more optimistic about America than I am about, the Memorial Day weekend traffic getting to Pittsfield and the Massachusetts Turnpike, but that's quite another story. I just think that we have grown so used over the past few years with all of these instruments like Twitter, and especially Twitter, actually, that we ignore the everyday aspects of American life that we ought to garner optimism from. I mean, the behavior of ordinary people, working every day, the great prospects of so many kids who are in high schools and grammar schools who represent our future in this country, that we ignore them. We concentrate so much on what's wrong and what's negative. And there are a lot of things wrong, and there's a lot of negativity that abounds in this country and in this world. But, the sun does come out, and people do smile on an everyday basis, and we should pay more attention to that than we do.
Mike, isn't that a problem with the profession, your profession, journalism, my profession, in that, our wonderful Rex Smith here always says, if 1,000 planes land safely at the airport, it doesn't rate a news story, but let one crash. So is that our problem?
Well, that's always been one of the big issues of the news industry. I don't know that it's a problem, because we have an obligation to report the news, and a lot of the news is ugly, and it is horrific, and it tends to bum people out. So that's always been the case, and Rex is absolutely right. I mean, 1,000 planes land safely a day, one crashes, that leads the news, and TV news especially is prone to, if it bleeds, it leads. How many car chases have we seen on the freeways of Southern California on CNN for 2 or 3 hours or whatever? But we do, I think, more so than we have in the past in the news business, tend to resort to a natural cynicism that is not healthy. Now, it's not ingrained in us as news gatherers or as journalists, but I think the cynical nature of government and politics over the past 10, 15, 20 years, the explosion of money into campaigns and what it's done to our politics, the behavior of many politicians once in office, the establishment of our presence in the Middle East through the false intelligence in Iraq, the longest war that we've been fighting now for over a decade, I think all of that has just led to deepen whatever cynicism is within us to begin with, as journalists and as citizens.
What are you hearing from your perch about Tsarnaev and the Boston bombing? Doesn't that fit pretty well into the paradigm that you're working with here?
I think the way the trial was conducted and the thoughtful nature of the jury and the tremendously emotional task of people like you and I sitting there over a number of weeks knowing that they had the fate of another human being in their hands is a testimony to the continuing greatness of our judicial system. That's the first thing that comes to my mind. There aren't many countries in the world that would have behaved the way we behaved in this instance, and the way we behaved after September 11th, actually, where Tsarnaev, he got a fair trial. There's a lot of back and forth, about the death penalty being rendered by the jury, but, I didn't sit on that jury, and I wasn't there in that courtroom each and every single day, and I did not see I've seen it since, but I did not see when the jury was shown the video, one of the videos of Tsarnaev, then 19 years of age, placing his backpack with his pressure cooker bomb inside the backpack directly behind young 8-year-old Martin Richards and his family. And it's nearly 4 minutes long that he stood there. And once during that 4-minute period of time, Martin Richard turned, and Tsarnaev had to have seen him, knew what he was doing, knew where he was, left it there, knowing the capacity that was in of destruction that was within that backpack. So, you know, I don't know what my reaction would have been had I sat on that jury. I certainly would have found him guilty. But in the death penalty phase, I don't know what my reaction would have been, and I'm glad I didn't have to make that decision, actually.
Very thoughtful. Mike, you're heading to the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute's annual Mona Sherman Memorial Lecture at our wonderful Colonial Theater in Pittsfield. How important do you think people keeping up is? I mean, that's the beauty of this organization, and a wonderful organization it is, to sort of make sure that everybody stays on top of things, uses their minds. What do you make of all of that?
Oh boy, I think that's, you know, one of the critical aspects of, as we grow as individuals, not grow older as individuals, but grow as individuals. I mean, we have so many tools at our fingertips now that my parents never had, your parents never had, our grandparents certainly never had. And the ability to stay in tune with things, to stay in touch with things, to continue to hold a firm grasp on reality, to increase your health, both physical health and your mental health, by reading, by knowledge, is a tool that should not and is not wasted, certainly through this organization and its efforts and over the years. And it's one of the things. There aren't many ways you can defeat growing older. You know, I can only think of two. One is if you have a lot of kids, a lot of children in and around your household, they'll keep you young for a long period of time. And the other way is to just stay in touch with the times, just to know what's going on, to know who Jay-Z is, as well as who George W. Bush is, or Jeb Bush, or Barack Obama, or his cabinet, or whatever. You know, to know bits and pieces about the culture around us, to know that, you know, Wednesday night was Dave Letterman's last show. To know that there was a great deal of interest in a TV series called Mad Men that ended a week ago. Things like that keep you in touch with reality so you know what's going on, so you don't feel like a stranger within your own environment as it progresses apace around you.
Well, as they say on Law and Order, Counselor, you open the door. So now that you've mentioned some of those presidential people, what do you got? Who's going to – what are we going to end up with? My bet is on, you know, Hillary versus Jeb, but that's pedestrian. What do you think?
No, I kind of agree with you on that. You know, I kind of agree that it more likely than not will be Hillary Clinton against Jeb Bush. But, I mean, the underlying theme to me that is more than a bit disconcerting is the cost of their campaigns. Mm. I mean, Jeb Bush is now, I'm told, or I read – that his goal, and he's almost reached it, is to raise $100 million before the middle of this summer. Hillary Clinton, in addition to being paid, she and her husband, nearly $30 million for speeches over the last 14 or 15 months. That's 14 or 15 months, not years, $30 million, has already raised hundreds of millions of dollars, or will soon raise hundreds of million dollars for her campaign. And that sort of precludes anyone else with no access to big, big money from running for president. And I think there are people in this country, you know, who would be willing to serve in the United States Senate or the United States Congress and perhaps be potential candidates for president, not this time around, but they don't do it for a couple of reasons. One is, who wants to be on the phone nearly every day of the week when you're in office raising money, which is what all of these people do, both congressmen, senators, as well as obviously candidates for president, raise money every single day on the phone, ask people for money, beg people for money. And the other thing, we talked about this earlier, is the nature of the media. That if you stole, you know, $12 in your paper route from Mrs. Mulahi in Pittsfield, you know, delivering the transcript in 1952, or 1962, that's going to be on the front page of the paper today. He stole $12 from Mrs. Mullahy. You know, he smoked a joint in the back seat of a car in Pittsfield or in Holyoke, you know, in 1978. That's going to be on the front page of the paper. So people say, I don't want any part of that. It's the nature of our politics, I think, that is most upsetting to me, not the fact that the really limited choices we have for president, and they are limited because of the money, which is another big, big, big concern.
Mike Barnicle, sitting next to me is our producer, Ian Pickus, our news director here, and he just wanted to send in a question, which is, what about them Red Sox?
What about them Red Sox? You know, this is the reason that they play 162 games, this stumbling start that we've gotten off to this year. It's not great. The pitching staff certainly has to be reworked and rebuilt. But for years, every year, for nearly 30 years, every spring, I'd go to spring training, and I'd write a column about the Red Sox in spring training, and nearly every year, I would end up with the sentiment that this is the year. Now, I was right a couple of times, oddly enough, but not every year. But, I mean, the beauty of the Red Sox is just the joy, at least for me, personally. Other than being on my front porch or in my home with my family, the place where I feel most at home is sitting in my seats at Fenway Park. There's just a pace to the game of baseball and a history to my history with the Red Sox and that team and that town that gives me so much joy, continued joy, that I suffer through the losses with the constant hope that things will turn around and the knowledge that we play 162 games and it's really not even a third of the way through the season.
Have you heard JT's paying to the Red Sox?
I have. As a matter of fact, I am loosely connected to that song because, as you know, as I'm sure you know, he lives in Lenox, Massachusetts.
Indeed.
And he composed the song several years ago, pulled it together. He had always wanted to write a song about the Red Sox, and he finally did it and pulled it together, and it's featured on his new CD. But a week before he was asked to throw out the first pitch at a Sunday night Red Sox game, 2 weeks ago Sunday, I believe, or 3 weeks ago Sunday, our two oldest boys are in the film business, and they do a lot of work for ESPN. They've done a couple of 30 for 30s. They won an Emmy. That's my little, you know,
congratulations
there for my sons. They were called and asked if they would do a quick music video for the song.
Wow.
So they drove up from New York to Lenox and interviewed James and shot a couple of scenes in Lenox and shot a few more scenes with him on the Saturday night before the Sunday night game. And the video accompanying the song was shown during the game on ESPN Sunday Night Baseball.
Yeah. I once was interviewing Seiji Ozawa and Kim, James' wonderful wife. It was a TV show, and turned around to me and said, ask him about the Red Sox. So I said, what about the Red Sox? Ozawa's face goes into a big smile. And then we had a wonderful music critic, who said, yes, but what about the high C in the third piece? And he sort of said, yeah, that was good. And then he said, but let me get back to the Red Sox. So there is a passion with the Red Sox that I don't see anywhere else.
You know, there's only a couple of other clubs that have that intensity, I would say.
The Cubs, maybe?
The Cubs certainly have it, but theirs is a Midwestern intensity, and intensity is probably the wrong word to use for Midwestern fans. But the Cubs do have it. St. Louis has it, but again, it's in the gut of this country in the Midwest, and they're fiercely loyal to their teams, and they are intense to a certain degree about their teams. But the most noticeable difference, at least to me, occurred on the night of Game 4 in 2004, when the Red Sox finally won the World Series after 86 years, in that ballpark in St. Louis. I had a number of people, St. Louis fans, come up to me, pat me on the back in the eighth and ninth inning and said, you know, we're so happy for you. If we couldn't win it, congratulations. And at first I thought it was a trick because I'm from Boston, and we are rude and obnoxious as fans traditionally. and we have no gentleness in us towards other teams. But they were genuinely nice, and they were genuinely happy that we finally, the Red Sox, were going to win a World Championship. So, and that same aspect of human nature is within a lot of the Cubs fans. I mean, they are happy if they sit there and they lose and they have a bratwurst sandwich and a big, tall 16-ounce beer and they drive back to the suburbs of Milwaukee, because that's how big Chicago is. But there is that intensity in St. Louis and Chicago, to a certain degree, that still exists with the Red Sox.
We've been speaking with Mike Barnicle. He'll be in the Berkshires tonight to deliver the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute's annual Mona Sherman Memorial Lecture at the Colonial Theater in Pittsfield at 6. It's free. Be there. It's going to be a great event. Mike Barnicle, you're terrific. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
In the shadow of the Bronx machine, man, you can feel it smolder. Hold down at an attitude, and you get a little chip on your shoulder. Say something that's downright rude. Oh, damn them Yankees, outspending everybody.